The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, today we have a guest coming on, but I want to welcome you back. I mean, you've been, gosh, you went to New York, you went to New Orleans, then you went to Latin America. I mean, give us some of the insights from some of these trips.
Well, I'm just surprised that the year has passed as quickly as it has, and then I look at my travel schedule and realize just how it has slipped up on me. We're in November, coming up on the end of the year, and I don't want to forget to schedule in what we've had for several years now, question and answer exchange.
For our listeners to actually say, okay, I've been listening to the program, but these are still some of my questions. We've had them email those questions the last 3 years. Is that what you want them to do this year?
Yeah, I would, and we'll gather those over the next week or two and then craft our responses and interact with you in that way.
And so the website that they should go to is McIlvaney@McIlvaney.com.
That's the email address. They can send it to McIlvaney@McIlvaney.com. Questions specific in nature, whether it's politics, economics, geopolitics, finance, we'll do our best to either look back at interviews that we've done that address those things specifically, if you haven't listened to those specific interviews, or craft a response for
David,
you.
David, those have been some of my favorite shows, because actually we're getting a chance to have interaction with the listening audience. And some of the questions that have been crafted are just exquisite. It shows that people are paying attention.
Well, Kevin, you mentioned I was just getting back in town. I almost forgot I'd spent a week in New York. And then on the back side of that, we went to New Orleans and then Central America. And the New York conference was pretty fascinating. I did get to spend some time with some interesting people on Wall Street, whether it's Bill Fleckenstein, Felix Rohatyn, Jim Grant, Jim Chanos. Really interesting dialogue, specifically directly with them. And New Orleans was a very different time spent. That was the New Orleans Investment Conference. Mm-hmm. And I'll make that an annual event for myself. It's been years since we've done that. They started it in 74, and my dad was very involved.
It's one of the longest running conferences as far as particular financial viewpoint.
It's one that Don got involved with in about 1983 and all through the 80s. I was a keynote speaker at. So it's nice to go back. And I just wanted to comment on that because there was a sense of fraternity and camaraderie with the speakers who were there, who were around during the last bull market in precious metals. And I think understand more at a deeply philosophical level what the gold and silver markets are about. Not just price action and the current trends and, looking at candlestick patterns and technical analysis.
David, these are the ideologues. These are the guys who actually went because of a belief system back in the 70s. You mentioned it before. They weren't there necessarily for monetary gain. This is before a lot of these guys even had businesses. They were there saying, look what's happening to the United States now that we're off the gold standard.
Had a great time spent with the Aiden sisters, with Bob Prechter, with David Tice, with Ian McCavity. And Kevin, it was just conversations with them that were reminding me that we have in large part made this industry, not just participate in it.
At the people that you just mentioned.
Exactly. Yeah. And it was Bob Meyer who reminded me, maybe I didn't even know this, but he and my dad worked on getting the Krugerrand legal to own here in the United States, because during the context of sanctions against South Africa, the most popular one-ounce gold coin on the planet, and one of the only original one-ounce coins, because you remember all of the European fractional gold coins used to be parts of an ounce, just shy of a fifth, just over a quarter, and all these random calculations for what the gold content is in the coin. The Krugerrand was immensely popular because it was just straight up, very understandable, 1 ounce of gold, but you couldn't own it as an American.
Yeah.
So Bob said, I really enjoyed working with your dad on that project, making it legal. And I'm thinking to myself, that's right. I
mean, wow.
We have, since the early 70s, been central to this industry, not just sort of riding in the wake, that actually Don made the wake.
Well, and these were some of the same guys
exactly.
That made gold bullion itself, not just the Krugerrand, but made gold bullion itself re-legalized with the U.S. government. In the mid-1970s, it took the lobbying efforts of Jesse Helms and a lot of the support from these guys at this industry to actually say, yes, Americans can own gold again.
Yeah, there's only about 20 people, Kevin, that were the founding members of ICTA, the Industry Council for Tangible Assets, that worked on getting gold legalized, that have developed this industry. And, we've got this beautiful statue here in our office that was sent to us as an appreciation gift for Don because he's one of those 20 founding members. Now, at least half of those guys are dead and gone, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And but made that trip to New Orleans that much more important and special because it really is a small, tight-knit fraternity of people who were here 30, 40 years ago and really get it from a bottom-up perspective.
Well, and for people who listened to last week's program, the Aiden sisters actually fit into that category as far as analysis, and you met with the Aiden sisters last week.
Exactly. So trip to Central America was fantastic. They've been in Costa Rica for 35 years.
Right.
And Kevin, anytime I'm outside the United States, it definitely does bring perspective to our currency, first and foremost, but the markets in general, as you just get a different flavor and step away from the CNNs and the CNBCs and just the barrage of cheerleading. That's really all you get on those programs. So thoughtful insight from unexpected places, even from the cabbie here and there, whether it is Costa Rica, Latin America. Next week, Kevin will be back in Paris and Brussels on business.
Well, you know, David, it's interesting when you go down to Central America, we think of those as banana republics. You know, we just think of currencies coming and going and coming and going. But our guest today is actually someone who's saying, guys, you need to be paying attention. America's becoming the banana republic. It's all these poor countries, their currencies right now are actually rising against the U.S. dollar.
Well, I mentioned I just returned from Latin America, and there's certainly hubbub, a strong reaction to the Fed's monetization. Brazil, chief amongst them, but also China and Germany and other parts of the world, feeling like Bernanke is delivering on his promise at a helicopter drop.
David, on that subject, why don't we go ahead and go to our guest, Gregory Weldon. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Gregory before we get there?
Greg's written the Weldon Money Monitor, the Metals Monitor, a number of different reports for years now, and combines, as we've mentioned in past programs, both fundamental and technical analysis. And one without the other is just an obvious, it's missing something. When you bring those two together, it's a powerful force of both, you know, the general theme of a market, but also if there is transitions in the marketplace on a shorter term basis, what are those transitions and what might they signify? So it raises a lot of really good questions. That's one of the reasons why we have him on yet again. We have questions and he's asking similar questions to us. Sometimes our programs, Kevin, when we're overseas or recording from a distance, can be rough to hear because of connections. But the content is what I would focus on. And here today, we've got some great things to cover with him. For those who are interested, go to WeldonOnline.com. WeldonOnline.com, and he'll do a trial subscription to one of those reports, whether it's the Money Monitor, which is kind of his general macro themes, or the Metals Monitor, which is more specific to precious metals and actually your other commodities as well. So that's an offer that he'll make, as he has in the past, to our listeners, a trial subscription for 30 days. Take him up on that.
You know, and what's well worth looking at, if you don't even read the verbiage, the charts that he comes up with are fabulous. And so, you know, it's just sometimes he'll have a chart in there and you'll go, wow, he found the relevance of something. Why don't we go to that interview right now?
Want to look with Greg, thanks for joining us, what the purpose of QE2 is, this most recent announcement of $600 to $900 billion in Treasury purchases, and a whole host of other issues. Appreciate you joining with us.
Well, I think it's actually pretty simple because the real underlying economy is not demanding that money. Housing continues to erode. The labor market continues to worsen despite what the headlines might suggest. The chronic unemployment problem in the U.S. continues to get worse month in and month out. And bank lending, as you mentioned, continues to contract. And it was not more than a month, 5-6 weeks ago, that you had the worst single-week decline in U.S. bank lending ever. So from that perspective, I think that you have to then suggest that, you know, after QE1, which did nothing to address those issues, that QE2 is simply focused on boosting asset markets to provide some level of feel-good factor, you know, on Main Street, because really the underlying economy is not doing that at all.
Well, it seems like in some regards, the Fed is just playing mind games with the market. If it can induce a wave of confidence that a deflationary outcome won't happen with this central bank in control, then perhaps consumers will consume, perhaps lenders will lend, and everything will return to normal. And this is what's a bit concerning for me. Normal seems to be defined as the trend that we left behind as recently as 2006 to 2008. And there's really no appreciation at the Fed that that was not normal and was, in fact, the extreme end of credit expansion never seen to that degree here domestically or on a global scale.
I think you really did hit the nail on the head there when we discuss, you know, what is the Fed's purpose here. Certainly the purpose, you know, goes beyond the thought process that QE2 is going to in any way, shape, or form address the issues in the underlying macro economy, which continue to be dominated by a worsening deflation, in my opinion. When you look at U.S. housing, particularly when you look at the U.S. labor market, the headline gains in payroll employment notwithstanding, the chronic embedded unemployment dilemma in the U.S. continues to get worse every single month. And then when you look at bank credit, certainly there's no impetus in bank lending, even to the degree where it was not much more than 5-6 weeks ago. You had the single worst one-week decline in U.S. bank lending ever in outstanding bank credit. So I think it really kind of that understanding of those facts, and I don't think that's debatable, leads you to believe that the single focus of the Fed is the asset markets and the attempt to promote some level of reflation through dollar debasement. And it's a specific policy goal. I think Bernanke has been very clear on this in the past, that the Fed does not really care about the dollar. It's a laissez-faire attitude towards the currency, clearly.
Well, and so if we've got the newest round of dollar debasement, just to go back and rehash, the most recent is $600 billion in this round of quantitative easing, plus $250 to $300 billion that's being rolled over from agency and mortgage-backed securities paper and reinvested into treasuries. So you've got basically a $900 billion prop in the treasury markets between now and June. And they did leave the door open for further treasury purchases beyond that. The question here is, what are the Chinese thinking about, you know, one, either their dollar holdings with this dollar debasement, or two, an effective response to their own asset bubbles, whether it's real estate, inflation, which they're running officially at 3%, but more realistically, probably somewhere between 6 to 8%. Those are significant numbers. And then in the backdrop, you've got sort of the whole decoupling drumbeat, which is getting louder as people say, oh, well, look at the engine of growth in the emerging markets. Maybe, maybe not. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think that this is clearly becoming one of the big risks. It is kind of the thing now that the QE2 announcement is out of the way and met the best expectations from the market. You ask yourself two questions. The first one is, how much of that monetization has been priced into the market over the last 2 to 3 months? And then secondly, you ask yourself, what is the potential landmine that, you know, the unintended consequence buried deep in the sand that we might, you know, step on and detonate here going forward? And I think the currency dilemma, if you will, currency war going on, is one of those potential landmines. When you look at China, clearly even today they announced, you know, that banks will have to hold more in foreign exchange. They're trying to take measures to reduce the capital inflow and to take some of the pressure off in terms of this, of the pressure it does, in fact, put on them. On the flip side, you have, you know, academic think tanks out with reports, again, today, yesterday, that say, you know, the renminbi is still, you know, 20% undervalued along with a host of other Asian currencies. What strikes me as we look at this today is really QE1, first of all, came as somewhat of a surprise. It had a big impact in terms of, you know, driving emerging markets. And when you see that kind of same flow of money begin to get into some of the hot commodity markets and the hot commodity currency markets, I think you've reached a point where it's become extreme. We're working on a piece right now as we speak called, you know, I'm kind of attached the name dinosaur dollar to the U.S. dollar. It's the dino dollar, on the path to extinction as the world's reserve currency. And when I look at what's happening today specifically, the number of currencies that are beginning to break out to the upside against the dollar is impressive. And it ranges down to some of the poorest countries in the world. For example, the Nepal rupee is breaking out today. When you look at all of these Asian currencies, I mean, we can take a number of countries that people don't even normally look at, whether it be Fiji or Samoa or the Solomon Islands. You know, all of these countries have their own currencies. And these currencies, after decade-plus, you know, decline against the dollar, have now reversed hard and are beginning to appreciate against the dollar. You know, it's to the point where you are literally flooding the world with dollars, to the point where even the world's poorest currencies linked to the poorest countries are appreciating against the U.S. dollar. This seems to become problematic, you know, to the point where this really is, you know, a debasement of the dollar through deluge of dollars cursing throughout global capital markets.
So we continue to ask the question, what's the aim of the Fed at this juncture? If it is asset reflation. You know, I'm curious to know why they've moved on the 5 to 6 year treasury paper with a stated objective of bringing down long term interest rates, the 20 to 30 year stuff. See, I mean, again, kind of floating back to that objective, we had the announcement of $600 billion in liquidity, and then the 30-year treasuries sold off. Was the real target something quite different? Not long-term bonds, but perhaps corporate paper, commercial mortgage-backed securities? I mean, if you could say, okay, it's asset reflation, but they've actually spent money and are intending to spend money, the action speaking louder than the words here, in the 5 to 6 year range. Why is that event horizon? Why is 5 to 6 years significant to the Fed, if you were to guess?
Well, I think that the event horizon comment is very pertinent here because, you know, when you look at where the U.S. fiscal situation is right now, that's a black hole. And the event horizon, you know, in physics is that point which you've entered that black hole and you don't quite yet know it, but you're in the pull, the gravitational pull of the antimatter that's at the core of the black hole. This is the treasury market situation now in terms of, you know, trillion plus dollar deficits that need to be funded and trillion plus dollar deficits from 08 and 09 that need to be refunded because the treasury chose to do most of that funding in the 3 year note area. So when you look at, you know, 08, 09, 3 years out becomes 2011, 2012, not only do you have huge continuing funding needs, but you also have enormous refunding needs, and that in combination could significantly put pressure on interest rates, you know, in the short term, the mid-curve, and in the 5 year, the 3 year, the 2 year, which is something the Fed is desperately trying to avoid, any push higher in rates. Why? Because the underlying macro economy, final demand, the consumer, households, labor market, they're not healthy enough to withstand any significant rise in U.S. rates. And we're not even talking about, you know, how that might relate to what's going on in Europe now, where bond markets, bond yields are breaking out all over the place. So this becomes even more problematic for the Fed going forward. So I think they look at it as this is our last best chance to circumvent a true debt deflation. Because, you know, even more than asset reflation and the hope that there's some concurrent feel-good factor for the consumer in there somewhere who's still dealing with, you know, housing market that stinks and a labor market that's not creating jobs, is to ensure that those things don't become the dominant force again and drag us down into a real hardcore debt deflation, perhaps the likes of which we haven't even seen yet.
Yeah, because the transference thus far has been from the private sector to the public sector debt. We moved from bank balance sheets to the Fed balance sheet, expanded that pretty significantly to 2.4 plus trillion, and could certainly see a push to three, maybe even $4 or $5 trillion on the Fed balance sheet. But their real issue is, looking at Treasury debt, 70% of marketable debt matures over the next 5 years. So, you know, as you say, there's the asset reflation side. There is also this event horizon, which you move out to the 2014-2016 period, and are they, in fact, taking actions today in anticipation of large funding requirements or rollover issues? And unlike the geniuses on Wall Street, the geniuses at the Fed have taken a different action. You actually have companies out there who are issuing 50- and 100-year bonds for around 6%. Now, I don't think that's a good investment, but from a business management standpoint, you've got corporate executives saying, listen, this is cheap money. Yeah. I can borrow for 100 years at 6%, whereas the Treasury's approach has been quite different, saying, you know, basically, we can add as much debt to the balance sheet as we want because interest rates are next to zero. This is like free money. This is free money. And I'm beginning to think, Greg, that the Ivy League maybe is not buying as much as it used to. Folks at Fed and Treasury, what are they thinking? There is no such thing as a free lunch.
There's another big wild card here, too, because to date, foreign central banks have been in cahoots. The purchases of Treasury debt by foreign official accounts held in custody at the Fed have exploded, and they are making new highs. It's above $2.5 trillion now. It's up gross is about $165 billion over the last 6 weeks. Net, that's almost $90 billion in new Treasury debt purchases. And if you go back over the last 12 months, it's over $250 billion. You know, and households as well. Households and pension funds have been the other big buyers along with commercial banks. So not only has the Fed have this funding and refunding dynamic, but what happens if dollar debasement gets to the point where foreigners really decide enough is enough and they discontinue new purchases of U.S. Treasuries, let alone, you know, the Armageddon scenario for the Fed where, you know, foreigners or households begin to sell Treasury debt. So this is a whole other dynamic that needs to be considered as well. And this is part and parcel to what's going on with this currency war, because clearly, in my mind, those purchases of Treasury debt by foreign official accounts is directly linked to the specific debasement policies, you know, by the Fed as it relates to the dollar. So they're trying to prop up a dollar. At some point, I think they throw in the towel on that because the Fed doesn't care. And if the Fed doesn't care, why should they care? Well, of course they care because they hold a lot of dollars. And that's why you see things like gold and silver, you know, soaring, because the thought process is more and more those fresh dollars will not be held in dollars.
It seems like there really is two different mindsets. I mean, as an investor, you and I are looking at risk mitigation on the one hand, profit potential on the other. And when you're talking about, you know, foreign central banks buying treasuries, numbers of $90 billion presently, that's a pretty decent appetite. And I think we'd have to distinguish between perhaps our mindset as investors and their mindset running a parallel track to politicians who can't afford their currencies to appreciate relative to the devalued dollar. So it really is interest in treasuries today by foreign central banks is part and parcel to currency war. It's not a question of if or when, it is here and now.
Yeah, it really is. And I mean, the number of countries taking action, you know, more than just rhetoric and talk, but actual direct intervention or some other, you know, means of regulatory type action, obviously is on the rise. So, you know, that is one of the major risks out there that could, you know, somewhat torpedo the Fed's hoped for goal of keeping interest rates low and put them really on the burner in terms of, like you said, leaving themselves open to additional purchases. Yeah, $900 billion is a large number. I think it's what the market wanted, if not a little bit more than what the market wanted. But when you do the math, it seems small compared to the amount they may have to ultimately buy if they really are going to attempt to keep interest rates from spiking to the upside. And gosh knows where gold goes then. I mean, gold's already at 1,400. So if they have to continue to do this into 2012 and the numbers become bigger and they're double what we're looking at now, and you start to also take into account the potential for foreign central banks to, you know, increase their allocations to gold in their own reserves. I mean, China's reserves in September, largest single month increase ever, $100 billion in September, to take their reserves alone to a new high above $2.5 trillion. So the numbers are staggering in terms of, you know, what the Fed might have to do, and then in terms of what could happen theoretically even more so than what we've seen already in some of these, you know, resource assets and precious metals.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Do remember to write in your questions to McIlvaney at McIlvaney.com if you have anything that you would like us to address over the next several weeks.
But it's been fascinating. I mean, as you know, we've been in the precious metals business for close to 40 years, and to watch sort of the internal dynamics, there's certainly a lot of discussion about bubble dynamics as the price has moved aggressively here in the last few weeks, silver in particular, up 30-40% in a very short period of time. And the question that I think many investors are missing is what's happening on the other side. This is not a gold and silver bull market, but it really is a fiat currency bear market, and you've got investors taking into their own hands what little degree of control they can to insulate themselves from fiscal and monetary policy. And this go round, and this is perhaps what's different than the 1970s, we're not talking about fiscal and monetary policy of the United States, but fiscal and monetary policy replicated in similar form and fashion globally. So that it's not just a U.S. investor base that are looking at those assets for protection, but it's a global audience. And this is where, you know, kind of the law of large numbers has a pretty significant impact. $1 trillion worth of investable gold, $4 to $5 trillion in actual existence. But if you wanted to place your hands on actual metal today, there's about $1 trillion available, contrasted with $200 trillion in paper assets. And as people are worried either about the confiscatory nature of their own treasuries or just, again, coming back to broader fiscal and monetary policies, we're at 1,400 and we have yet to see the fireworks. That's what I want to talk to you about next, is the fireworks to come. Looking at 2011, we've got a decent rally in the stock market today. Our research would point us in the direction of being in a structural long-term bear market with this being a strong cyclical up move, what derails that here and globally? Is it commercial real estate? Is it continuation, part two of the residential real estate debacle? We've got 19 million homes still in inventory, roughly 40 months worth of inventory at today's sales pace. The residential side is awful. The commercial side has a lot more to give up. Or maybe it's still in Europe. If you look at kind of going back to the acronym, the PIGS, maybe it's Portugal, maybe it's Italy, maybe it's Greece, Spain, Ireland. Where do you think that the fireworks will be as we move into 2011 and 12?
Well, you certainly giving your listeners a lot to chew on right there, because we have a lot of different things we can touch upon within the context of what you just said, all of which is, you know, extremely accurate. The first thing I would say is that this is a much bigger experience in the precious metals than dollar. This is much bigger experience, certainly than, in my mind, than the 70s or 80s. I mean, you come into 80, 81, when gold spiked, I mean, they were ultimately trying to fight inflation. This is the exact opposite scenario. And when you do look at the fact that this is global in nature, it's very easily represented when you take any currency in the world, any single paper currency, including the strongest currencies in the world, yen, for example, and you take a gold-adjusted value of that currency. Simply take the currency, not the dollar currency, but the currency itself, inverted against the dollar, if you must do it that way, and then divide it by the price of an ounce of gold. Every single currency on the planet is either near or at new all-time lows in its valuation against gold. And every single currency is down from 1999 by anywhere from 60 to 85% in that gold-adjusted value. So that is where it becomes a much bigger thing when you talk about governments and central banks, let alone populations in places like Asia, allocating, you know, some portion of their wealth into gold or their reserves into gold. You haven't even seen the tip of the iceberg yet as it relates to the amount of capital that could flow into a market that really isn't deep enough to handle that amount of capital. And that's part of what you're seeing, you know, right here. So, yeah, you could say open interest in them, you know, and the futures market is high and the ETF demand has been large, and maybe that's some signs of a bubble. If that's true, it's a bubble that's still in its kind of infancy, because it's going to be global in nature, because it is already global in nature. On the other point, I might say all of the things that you said could be the potential downfall for equities. Equities have enjoyed this ride. I think it's interesting, of course, to note that the U.S. is, you know, still a severe laggard when you look at global equities. Still the growth and the highest rates of return are in Asia. But I think there is a point out there where there is a decoupling of asset prices, where equities kind of the musical chairs, and equity is going to be one with no chair to sit down in. And I think that could, in fact, come about as a function of the reflation in asset prices itself, specifically commodities. If you get food and energy prices continue to move kind of the way that they have been, energy is, again, another big laggard. If that starts to play catch-up or just, you know, matches the appreciation we're seeing in other commodities already, I think that could be very deflationary in its impact on consumers who are already, you know, margined out in terms of their discretionary flexibility and spending and whatnot, without the support of labor, without the support of house price reflation. I think that inflation in prices, particularly for food and energy, could be that sword that finally is, you know, that stake that's driven into the heart of the equity market at some point going forward.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because this last week in our Friday wrap-up comments on our wealth management site, it was one of the issues that we talked about, is that as you have commodity price inflation, that is a sort of taxation, additional taxation, not only in the consumer, but also on corporations who, to some degree, don't have the ability to reprice. In some instances, you can. In other instances, you cannot reprice fast enough.
And you're starting to hear talk about that. You really haven't until literally like the last few days, in my mind. Just, you know, you hear a little bit about it in the pop media. You mention it. I'm certainly thinking about it. So there's, you know, there's other people out there that are noticing this and starting to contemplate what this could mean, you know, down the road.
Well, back to the gold theme. I mean, we have the ETF, GLD, which is now actually all of the gold ETFs combined are now as large as the total futures market open interest in gold. And interesting as sort of a historical footnote, but there's also some power in that dynamic. And then, of course, the silver ETFs, they're larger in size than the net futures speculative positions, so not quite as large as the open interest in gold. But really what that says is that you're seeing the whole world expect physical demand to increase, and they're positioning themselves accordingly. They don't want a proxy for the price necessarily. I understand that a purist would view even the ETF as a proxy for the price, but the futures market is a different game altogether. And what we're seeing is individual investors and institutions, constructive interests, which are a real force in the marketplace, focus on physical metals, allocated metals, metals that are stored, not just a paper trade, so to say.
Yeah, and I mean, this has been the, you know, the trend slowly but surely all along. And I mean, it goes back, I mean, the book we wrote on trading gold back in 2005 and 2006, you know, we mentioned this, you know, when you hit that point where dollar debasement has become so egregious and policy has become academically at least irresponsible, it may not be irresponsible relative to the point of the goal, which is to circumvent deflation, which would be very painful. It becomes about pain avoidance, not about the academically correct thing to do. So, you know, understanding that, when that becomes evident, which is clearly has become evident now, these markets are just not deep enough still to handle the amount of physical investment that could take place on a real hardcore kind of store of value panic, if you will. And I think we're seeing that in action, you know, here over the last week since the Fed made their announcement.
Yeah, that's very true. The book that you mentioned, you wrote back in 2005 and 6, and I'd encourage all of our listeners to get it, not just leave it on the shelf, but Gold Traders Bootcamp is a very good read and laid out a framework which at that point put a very high and amongst many respected in the investment community, unreachable number for gold at about 1,200. Now, so we've passed 1,200, we're several hundred dollars higher. What are the dynamics that you see in play today, consistent with the book you wrote several years ago, that put this, as you say, in the infancy of a bubble stage, not necessarily a progressed state or nearing the end of a bubble?
Yeah. Our thought process at the time had been clearly the initiation of all of this would be, you know, a credit crisis that was a function of a collapse in housing in the U.S., and that clearly was the driving force. You know, we've gone through exactly that. The next step would be the Fed would become, you know, quote-unquote, academically irresponsibly easy to circumvent a debt deflation from being the end result of that collapse in housing and credit, and that that would drive gold, you know, to the $1,200 level. That's happened. So from here, it's a little more tricky because, you know, you have to ask yourself, do you have to get some kind of renewed collapse in, you know, equities and the macroeconomy to drive things further in terms of being the catalyst for the Fed to become even more irresponsible? And then if and when that happens, is that a thing that is kind of, you know, hyperreflationary in nature that ultimately collapses unto itself as prices become too high where you can't afford anything? And if housing and jobs don't respond, you don't have the support you need to make it sustainable to any degree, let alone, you know, to some degree. So I think that when I look at what happens from here, we're kind of now in the phase where we suggested you would, you know, you'd really accelerate to the upside because the Fed would be monetizing Treasury debt specifically for this exact reason, which is to, you know, circumvent a spike in interest rates that comes about from a funding refunding problem. So you're in that phase now. How high we go in this phase, you know, I mean, the numbers that I had in my head at the time even, which you wouldn't even mention publicly because they would seem ridiculous, and I never want to be labeled a gold bug because I'm not, is the $2,500 level. But let me give you something interesting, and I really make the caveat that I'm not saying this is my forecast by any stretch of the imagination, but if you take what's happening in the five-year note yield, and let me just backtrack real quick. I think it's an important point to make in terms of evidence of the debasement of the dollar is very, very clear to me. When you suggest somebody that bought one of these three-year notes that the Treasury issued in, say, 2008 as part of TARP or whatever programs are going on at the time, you bought that, you were safe in the Treasury, you're going to get your money back in 2011, you know, maybe you got a modicum of yield, wow, big deal, wasn't much to, you know, even to compensate for the risk. The problem is that the dollars you spent to buy that bond, the dollars you get back when the bond is redeemed, buy you only half the gold it did 3 years ago. Here is the debasement of the dollar in terms of its purchasing power, and specifically using the metric of gold to define that. Going even further, though, when we start to contemplate where was the five-year note yield 5 years ago, when we wrote the book, one of the dynamics that helped us come up with the $1,200 target was looking at gold relative to interest rates on ratio basis and, you know, on adjusted value basis, then comparing that to the 1980 high, 1200 came up at the number that was being projected by the five-year note yield 5 years ago. All right, what is projected now, with the fact that the five-year note yield is now even at, you know, deeper record lows, is the focus of this Fed monetization program. I can tell you that that same measurement that gave us a $1,200 target 5 years ago points to $9,600 an ounce for gold right now.
Well, as you say, this gets tricky because it's partially an economic issue, it's partially a financial issue, and where it's likely to accelerate to the upside is we move into an era of politics being front and center in the equation. You know, you've got the Portugal, Italy, Ireland, Greece, and Spain as a perfect case in point here, where austerity measures have been introduced, whether it's, you know, extending the retirement age or cuts in wages or lots of different measures. Fiscally, this is where those options are being exhausted. And here in the United States, as we look at the recent reaction in the election, it appears that spending is now radioactive in the opinion of voters. So again, the fiscal policy measures are being exhausted, which points to a speeding up of the monetary endgame.
It really puts the focus on the ECB, in my mind, because they have, to the degree that they've bought debt in Europe, it's been sterilized. You know, they withdraw that liquidity that's created by their purchases. It's going to be problematic if that is their policy going forward when you either have, you know, one of two scenarios. You have fiscal austerity that drives the economies towards ruin, or, you know, they react and you have a whole another monetization coming out of Europe where the euro is the one that's being debased. And, you know, so I'm watching gold priced in euro currency very closely on this. I'm watching the ECB very closely on this because Europe has a major, major problem here. Bond yields are breaking out across the board here. France, for example, I mean, their bond is up today to the point where, I mean, they had their budget numbers came out this morning, and while they're better year over year, they still stink. You know, I mean, the dynamics in terms of revenue versus income and all the innards of the budget are not healthy at all. So I think this is something we've been talking about all year long since really the third quarter of last year. And it's like, okay, well, this is bullish for gold on the one hand, because if the euro isn't a currency you want to own and the dollar isn't a currency you want to own, here it is again, all currencies declining relative to gold, so that's kind of bullish for gold. Yet on the other hand, you also fear that the ECB doesn't play ball and you have, you know, fiscal austerity that drives economies into the ground, which actually hurts gold as you get a general renewed deflation in asset prices that is a function of, you know, a real debacle developing in Europe. And that debacle is not going to be solved easily monetarily anyway. So it really creates, when you say tricky, I think that, you know, that the tricky environment is in front of us. And I think it's specifically linked, you know, to your currency dynamic, which is tricky, but even more so to Europe, which is really tricky.
It dawns on me that there could be some interesting real estate values in Spain or some of these countries as they leave the European Monetary Unit, devalue their debt, devalue their currency, alleviate their debt, and then continue to see pressure in their real estate markets with certain countries. I mean, Spain's got a 44% unemployment rate in their sub-30 category, under the age of 30. That's just monstrous, and it's the kind of thing that revolutions are made of.
Yeah.
Which again, you know, the whole stability of the EMU and the euro as a monetary unit, yet alone as some sort of a hack political construct, this does make it very tricky. But it makes it also, I think, an easier, less tricky route for a lot of central bankers to push the pedal to the metal on the monetary side and create more liquidity. The ECB is, as you mentioned, the ECB has been very critical of our move. And now even within the Fed, you've got Kevin Warsh, you've got Richard Fisher, you've got Thomas Honig, all saying, listen, we're very concerned about the implications of additional government debt purchases. Yeah, so there's some discontent there with the decision already put in motion.
I think part of the problem is it really synergizes the dichotomy, you know, really the polarization of pressures as it relates to inflation on the one hand and deflation at the same time. So I really believe it does make it exceptionally tricky for central bankers around the world, a job I would never covet, as it relates to trying to formulate a policy that addresses both of those extremes. You know, it's almost like they call it the one extreme. On the other hand, trying to fight the second extreme, and the one extreme then exacerbates the second extreme, and it just becomes a complete mess. And then I ask myself, isn't that where, you know, people just want to own gold instead of anything else? And, is this dynamic only going to get more intense?
I sat at a table, a lunch table, about 2.5 weeks ago, and I guess I didn't realize I sat down at the speaker's table. But Jim Grant joined us, Felix Rohatyn joined us, Bill Fleckenstein joined us. There was about 4 or 5 people sitting there, and the conversation was fascinating, particularly Felix Rohatyn's comments, because, I mean, talk about bearish beyond bearish. And this is a guy who, in the investment banking world with Lazard, has had his fingers on tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars worth of merger and acquisition deal, a true Wall Street insider. And yet there was a black cloud hanging over Mr. Rohatyn, and it seemed to drift as the conversation went on into Jim's mind space as well. Just this, we're painted into a corner. There's no easy solution here. The outcome is going to be ultimately very painful, and that does point, at least at a popular level, to people insulating themselves with the metals position. But I can't really get any more creative than that, particularly when it comes to the political side. Perhaps that's where I've become most cynical, is in the area of politics. We've covered a lot of ground today, a little bit on the dollar, a little bit on long bonds. Anything that we should keep in mind in terms of public policy and future legislative risks, or final comments on the areas we've been talking about?
Well, I mean, certainly protectionist measures in the U.S. and other countries is a primary risk right now, and that, of course, links back to the, you know, persistent debasement of the dollar and how that affects other countries. And, of course, Europe is, to me, right now, the primary risk. It's been kind of put on the back burner throughout this year several times. And, you know, again, when you talk about politics and politicians, they repeatedly tell us it's going to be fine in Europe, and it's not going to be fine in Europe. So, you know, I wonder when that, I think you're on the verge, if not, you know, having already started in the last week or so, you know, destroying that thought process that everything is not going to be all right. This is not an easy fix. It's not even something that can be easily monetized. So it's highly problematic when you start seeing bond yields in Europe break out pretty much across the board. And I would just mention, too, just on more of a short-term basis, even looking at, you know, some of the areas of interest in bond markets where bond yields are breaking out kind of on their own measure. Australia, New Zealand, some of these countries stand out. You notice a little bit of a breakout in the Australian bond market. You notice a little bit of a breakout in the, you know, the forward strip, implying that there's going to be a little bit more aggressive rise in short-term interest rates in places like that, which then could theoretically feed onto the currency as the Fed keeps U.S. rates low, rate differentials blow out, the currencies get even stronger, which makes it even more problematic at some point going forward, even for banks that are as highly respected as the Reserve Bank of Australia. So there is so much to watch. And again, I come back to my comments earlier, the piece we're writing today, and any of your listeners are free to go to our website and get a free trial to our research. I mean, today's piece really looks at currencies that are not in the mainstream, that are not widely discussed or held or watched. Yet these currencies, again, linked to some of the poorest countries in the world, are breaking out against the dollar. And I think that says volumes in terms of how extreme the debasement of the dollar has gotten already. And, you know, this is why silver's up $5 in a week.
Well, Greg, I think any of our listeners who don't go to WeldonOnline.com and take you up on the free trial would be crazy. It's a great report. The Money Monitor, the Metals Monitor, very good. And as a trial run, certainly, and as a longer-term prospect to subscribe, it makes sense. There's great information. You're plugging through a lot of details and a lot of data on a daily basis. I tried to explain to everybody here in the office this morning that's only possible, you know, man who's, what, 6'10"? And probably into his third pot of coffee by 2:30 in the morning. I don't know, maybe you don't drink coffee at all, but you seem to get a lot done between your writing forays and management forays into the world of finance.
We do. I mean, I do. It's a kind of a one-man show here. I really don't have any staff on the research side. I do all the data digging, all the charting and technical analysis, and then all the writing comes strictly from my head. So, you know, it is a pretty daunting task, but I love doing this so much. It becomes easy. It's, you know, I'm a high-energy guy, and yes, I do drink 2 or 3 pots of coffee a day to keep on a roll. But we do. We like to dig everywhere. We dig into the minutiae of the data to find out where are the potential trend changes and then, you know, monitor those things as they rise in the level of awareness and visibility, you know, more towards the macro side. And then, of course, you know, I would love to blend that macro thematic thought process and get confirmation or, you know, repudiation from the markets themselves from a bottom-up technical standpoint. And we do a lot of quantitative work too on the markets, so we like to take it from all angles. We like to dig deep, and we like to be comprehensive.
And a great first read and introduction to that thought process would be your book, Gold Traders Bootcamp. We had that as an office read, and I think it's a good one to have, not only on the shelf, but well underlined and learned from. So appreciate you joining us, and look forward to future conversation as we dig into, as you say, that the macro thematics, pretty important stuff to get figured out in this environment, with wealth protection and asset protection being a priority, and trying to ferret out, looking for a needle in the haystack for those growth opportunities as well.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Well, David, that was another fascinating interview. We interviewed Mr. Weldon a couple of years ago, and the things that he has said have actually come to pass. And that reminds me of a lot of the guests, like Napier and Faber. These guys, what they're saying seems to be playing out. Makes it worth listening.
I think consistently, Kevin, there is a growing theme around this event horizon over the next 5 to 6 years. Mm-hmm. Whether it was Russell Napier suggesting an ultimate bottom of equities in the 2014 to 2016 period, rivaling a period only seen in 32, 49, 82, those specific periods in market history.
Well, and doesn't that match this time period we're talking about, buying of the 5 and 6 year treasuries? It seems like these things all coordinate.
Exactly. There's some things that are coming into play that make the next 5 to 6 years utterly fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll continue to do our best to make sense of what's happening with guests such as Greg and a whole host of others. Send those comments and questions in. We'll be answering the questions over the next couple of weeks if you send them to McIlvaney@McIlvaney.com, and that'll focus our conversation over the next couple of weeks on what's still on your minds.
I'm looking forward to those questions. Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. You can find us on the internet at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.